in the death and the murder of my father. We have been waiting for the suspension for 1 year now. There is no progress at all. We are waiting for a reaction, a real one.
Asa Traore is the sister of Adama Traore, murdered also by the neo-neck choke, the same method that killed George Floyd. That led to a worldwide protest asking the ban on such dangerous techniques.
That technique of immobilization used by police forces must be forbidden. That technique is fatal. We have denounced that method for 4 years now because Adam Traore died exactly the same way as Sedric Chauviat, with a knee on his neck. Both said their last words, "I can't breathe." If French authorities had listened to us, Sedric Chauviat would not have died.
This protest is not only against police violence, but also against a global security law that would facilitate police violence, or at least would make it more difficult to film police violence. It's thanks to video footage that the beating of a music producer in Paris by police officers last November was made public.
Abnormal things are happening in this country from the police side. The government is obliged to react because there is an important mobilization, especially from the youth, against the global security law. It's important to withdraw that law.
The march ended under the Eiffel Tower, the place where Cédric Chauviat was choked to death. Cédric Chauviat died with a knee on neck choke. As long as this method will not be forbidden by the French government, the impunity of police officers will continue. Chris Den Hond, Paris.
On the first anniversary of the U.S. assassination of Iranian commander General Qasem Soleimani and his companions, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip came together to thank the general for his support in their struggle against the Israeli aggression.
The assassination of General Soleimani has not stopped Iran's support for the Palestinian cause. Our resistance will continue until the liberation of Al-Quds. The blood of General Soleimani will not go in vain. General Soleimani made a turning point in the history of the Palestinian cause.
Many Palestinian leaders and officials joined the mourners and expressed gratitude to Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, who was assassinated in a U.S. airstrike in Baghdad on January. Palestinians consider General Soleimani a symbol of resistance for all the oppressed Palestinians.
We stress that the resistance will continue till all Zionist plots are thwarted in the region. The path of General Soleimani will continue. His assassination has made us more determined to keep the resistance alive.
Palestinians stress that they will follow in the footsteps of General Soleimani, who had a major role in supporting the Palestinian resistance in different fields and making a big difference in the balance of deterrence and rules with the Zionist regime.
General Soleimani was assassinated because he was supporting the resistance front. He always cared about Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and Palestinians. His assassination has made us more united in our fight against the occupation.
Similar gatherings were held in other parts of the region to commemorate the Iranian top commander. Palestinians here consider General Soleimani a symbol of resistance. They say they will continue his path of struggling against the Israeli occupation until the liberation of Palestine and Jerusalem Al-Quds. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Thank you. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
According to a new study published in Communications Earth and Environment, the largest inland body of water on Earth, the Caspian Sea, is on a particularly precipitous decline. Scientists are now warning this salty body of water will fall between 9 and 18 meters, 30 and 59 feet, by the end of the century. If emissions continue to rise, a decline of that magnitude would evaporate nearly the entire northern Caspian Shelf and some of the Turkmen Shelf to the southeast. Researchers say the eastern margin would be completely desiccated. In the worst-case scenario of an 18-meter drop in sea level, models show 34% of this sea surface area will shrink. And yet, this enormous crisis is still thoroughly underappreciated by the public. Even the scientific community is largely unaware of what's going on. The International Panel on Climate Change has not addressed lake evaporation from climate change in any of its reports, nor has the United Nations addressed the issue in its Sustainable Development Goals. If nothing is done, the consequences to the environment will be immense. The projected decline in sea level will severely impact this unique ecosystem, and the loss of shallow water in the south will deprive endemic fish, birds, and seals of invaluable habitat, spawning grounds, and food sources. Here we present you an article in this regard written by Carly Casella under the heading, "It May Be Too Late to Save the World's Largest Lake from Climate Change." This article has appeared on the front page of thescientealert.com. Please stay tuned. Most people know the world's oceans are on the rise. But further inland, the scales of climate change are tipping in the exact opposite direction. As melting glaciers feed fresh water on the oceans, heat and drought are draining our lakes and inland seas of precious liquid. According to a new study published in Communications Earth and Environment, the largest inland body of water on Earth, the Caspian Sea, is on a particularly precipitous decline. Scientists are now warning this salty body of water will fall between 9 and 18 meters, 30 and 59 feet, by the end of the century, if emissions continue to rise. A decline of that magnitude would evaporate nearly the entire northern Caspian Shelf and some of the Turkmen Shelf to the southeast. Researchers say the eastern margin would be completely desiccated. In the worst-case scenario of an 18-meter drop in sea level, models show 34% of this sea surface area will shrink. And yet, this enormous crisis is still thoroughly underappreciated by the public. Even the scientific community is largely unaware of what's going on. The International Panel on Climate Change has not addressed lake evaporation from climate change in any of its reports. Nor has the United Nations addressed the issue in its Sustainable Development Goals. The authors of the new paper write,
the impacts of the overlooked facet of future sea level change, falling levels of lakes and seas in the continental interiors on a global scale could be similarly devastating as global sea level rise and threaten the livelihood of millions of people worldwide. Due to its size, about 371,000 square kilometers, that is about 143,000 square miles, and its salinity levels of around 1.2%, the Caspian was deemed a sea instead of a lake. Without immediate and coordinated action, the Caspian Sea will serve as a poster child for receding lakes in a rapidly warming world, the authors say. A global task force is therefore urgently needed. If nothing is done, the consequences to the environment will be immense. The projected decline in sea level will severely impact this unique ecosystem, and the loss of shallow water in the south will deprive endemic fish, birds, and seals of invaluable habitat, spawning grounds and food sources. The new paper concludes, the expected escalating effects of Caspian Sea decline are likely to lead to a wholesale reorganization of ecosystems and threaten unique Caspian biota that have been evolving in a basin over millions of years. Even those areas of the Caspian Sea already protected will be transformed beyond recognition as deposits of nutrients bypass these rising shelves to head straight to the central part of the basin. Dead zones will likely emerge as temperatures grow hotter and rivers carry less oxygen to the sea, impacting both the shallowest and deepest waters of the inland sea, similar to what's already happening in some parts of the world's oceans. The geopolitical consequences are also terribly worrisome. Local economies depend on fishing and maritime trade will be affected irrevocably, as will coastal ports, which will suddenly find themselves much further from the water. The loss will also likely exacerbate water scarcity issues in the arid region, no doubt causing international disputes. Experts predict, as the livelihoods and food security of millions of people depend on the Caspian Sea, a loss of these ecosystem services will have drastic socio-economic consequences and may trigger local and regional conflicts. And this is hardly just a problem for the Caspian Sea. A few recent studies have shown falling water levels in enclosed seas and lake systems, largely due to continental drying from climate change. Because lakes do not have an outflow, they are particularly vulnerable to rising temperatures. Their water level is almost solely determined by precipitation, river inflow, and evaporation. The same is true of the Caspian Sea, which relies on the Volga River for its inflow. Precise models for lake retreat around the world are desperately needed to save these precious ecosystems and the economies and societies they support. Unfortunately, it's too late to save the Caspian through emission cuts alone. Already, the inland body of water is declining at a rate of 6 to 7 centimeters, 2.4 to 2.8 inches each year. Intense regional adaptation and mitigation efforts are therefore desperately needed. Public awareness would be a good place to start. For decades now, the decline of inland lakes has been misunderstood and overlooked even by the experts. The authors wrote, for example, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's first assessment report suggested an increase in Caspian Sea level from about 2010 onwards, adding, none of the IPCC Thin Thesis reports considers this issue further. A sheer lack of research is part of the problem. The risks and vulnerability of the Caspian Sea due to water loss have barely been studied at all. Based on the case of the Caspian Sea, the authors are calling for a global campaign to raise awareness and improve research for the world's shrinking lakes and inland seas. They have been neglected for too long. Matthias Prang, who creates climate models at the University of Bremen in Germany, said, many people are not even aware that an inland lake is dramatically shrinking due to climate change, as our models indicate, adding, this has to change. We need more studies and a better understanding of the consequences of global warming in this region.
Primarily liberation. Perhaps following the collapse of the most populated city of Iraq after Baghdad, that is Mosul, Daesh militants reckoned they would go to Amirli for picnics and hunting trips during the weekends to add Turkmen people there to their collection of Arabs and Kurds killed and captivated by them. However, they were not aware that their Amirli picnic area would become the one battleground determining their fate. Usually, the popularity of a public figure in any country is limited to its borders. In spite of this, there are some artists whose huge fame has exceeded their country's borders. Politicians, however, oftentimes do not enjoy such fame. Military men have even a lesser chance in this regard. However, remember this, that the two countries of Iran and Iraq less than 30 years earlier had been engaged in the world's last classic war, which lasted longer than World War II. What changed the equations that now senior Iranian commanders had become the most popular Iranian figures among the Iraqi people? Amirli is a township in Saladin province located less than 100 kilometers from the Iranian borders. It is comprised of Sunni and Shia Muslims, Kurds and Turkmens. Some say the local inhabitants are descendants of Turkish migrants who moved here from Anatolia. Others say the inhabitants are of Iranian and Azerbaijani origin. Despite speculation in this regard, Amirli today has become a source of pride for the historical lands which host cities including Babylon, Baghdad, and Ctesiphon or Mada'in. Is the prosperity of a land limited to the amount of rain it gets and the degree of its fertility? Here in this desert land, you see prosperity shouting out loud. Do you not see souls blossoming here? Do you not see God's blessing blowing across these desert lands? Little girls will become teachers and nurses one day. They might become homekeepers. They will surely be mothers and tell their children stories about the conflict. They will relate memories of the difficult times. However, in between these stories, I'm sure they will mention the names of their heroes as well. Amirli is under siege. It is surrounded inside a 360-degree circle. In other words, any person in town can take a rifle in hand and become one of the thousands of fighters guarding the town with eyes wide open day and night to stop the enemy from attacking and infiltrating from any point through the lines using their suicide bombers. Being under siege means one not being able to even wish for getting the slightest amount of rest in Amerlin. Being under siege means that even if all the fighters die defending the town, the girls will have at least one grenade tucked into the corner of their shawls. Thousands of novels, films, and pictures have been made about the occupation of Paris by the German Nazis and the bombardment of Pearl Harbor by the Japanese. However, very little has been made by them about the bombardment of Dresden in Germany by the British, and the same story goes for the destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They have no mercy on themselves. They will not help us. They will neither mourn our dead ones nor observe 1 minute silence in honor of those of us who were killed in the genocide. Why should we wait until the genocide of thousands of people in Amerlin becomes the headline of a local newspaper? We have decided to take our destiny into our own hands, to have history record our fate in a different way. It was not the first time that a helicopter was headed to Amerlin to transfer an old person in critical condition or a pregnant woman about to give birth to the nearest safe place. When a siege lasts more than a month, there is no guarantee that it would not last for a year. When the siege becomes lengthy, the people who are more important than the leading male figures and the brave fighters are the mothers who accompany them. These mothers will prepare a piece of bread to send their fully fed men to the war front, and they will put their children to bed by promising to give them treats later on. These women are the ones who sing the children's lullabies loudly so their men do not get distressed by hearing them cry for lack of medicine. In late spring 2014, Daesh was celebrating its honeymoon. The oil they had seized from Syria's Deir ez-Zor had fueled their move to northern Iraq, where they also gained access to huge water supplies. Prior to the collapse of Mosul, they were more similar to a militia force. However, now by taking Mosul, they had gained access to enough military hardware to turn them into a classic army. Taking $500 million from the central bank in Mosul brought Daesh closer to establishing its self-proclaimed caliphate of Iraq and Levant. Despite Daesh forces' insistence for symbolically using traditional weapons and doing decapitations, the link between Daesh and modernism is an odd story. The Daesh forces were mobilized from across the globe, particularly Europe and Northern Africa, using Twitter and Facebook to recruit militants. YouTube published Daesh video trailers showing killings and plundering, letting the militant group to sow the seeds of terror and fear. The domino-like fall of the cities of Mosul, Tikrit, and Fallujah, alongside the unwarranted massacre of 1,500 Iraqi servicemen at Spiker Air Base, would demoralize fighters who had been defending the cities. The bigger the city, the less resistance they would show against Daesh. However, the small towns turned into difficult targets for Daesh to take. The smaller the town, the more resistance it showed against the enemy. Al-Fo'a and Kafaria, as well as Nubla and Azara, and now Amerlin. News was slowly spreading that help was on its way. 16 days has passed since Amerlin had been encircled by the enemy. Telling anybody that help was on its way was regarded as an untimely joke. When they talked about help coming, they would look into the skies. The strongest believers among them could not imagine for a second that even God's own angels would be willing to set foot in this hellhole. However, when dozens of youths spent 2 hours in the southeast of the town clearing the ground of rocks for a makeshift helicopter pad, there was no noise sweeter than that of a helicopter arriving in Omerli. Perhaps there were some armed men around here to know that the passengers of this aircraft were far from regular. Say, a Daesh sniper wanted to target one or two of them. Which ones would he shoot? Neither one of them had any military insignia on their uniforms, not an olive wreath nor a black or gold eagle to distinguish them and show their rank. Just a group of determined senior and younger men whose skin had been tanned under the sun. Even the sad and suffering people of Omerli had no idea which passenger was to be given the most attention and respect of all. When we review the list of the martyrs of Haram, not even one of them had been killed in Omerli. This proves that all that they needed was to have their spirits uplifted. The presence of General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis did this and lifted their spirits. We did not have the feeling that a stranger from another country was among us. In fact, we counted him as one of our own. Some of the inhabitants of the town were hopeful that help would come from outside town. Some were even hopeful that international organizations would send help. They followed the news on international channels. Neither in the headlines nor in the body of the articles there was any mention of Omerli. News coverage about the extinction of tigers in 2014 was more important than the genocide of the people of Omerli. If there were some who were still doubtful about defending the town, after they saw the refugees of Tal Afar fleeing from their homes with eyes filled with fear, their doubts were gone. They had now become ready soldiers, counting the minutes to get the order from their commander to engage the enemy. When the helicopter was ready to fly, it should have taken the shortest path to reduce the risk of being hit by missiles. However, General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis insisted that the helicopter should pass above the enemy positions so they could see how many they were and what equipment they had. So now that he was monitoring the enemy front line from the ground, he could give precise coordinates to the artillery guns to strike the enemy positions. One must justify the Omerli host's concerns when he crossed over the front line wearing his everyday civilian clothing. As usual, you're not wearing a bulletproof vest. The only protection you have is the holy strip of cloth strapped to your arm, alongside the blessings of millions of women and children in the region that guards you against harm. I doubt that any fighter in any combat could match you in bravery. However, we have grievances about Iraq related to the events that took place in the month of Muharram of the year 61 of the Arabic lunar calendar, and to the month of Day of the year 1398 of the Iranian solar calendar. It is naive to think that the commander was simply looking at the enemy front line to monitor it. By looking at the front line, he was figuring out the enemy's underlying strategy. He was not looking at what was currently just threatening Iraq and Syria. He was figuring out the dangers that were threatening others thousands of kilometers away. Your turn will come. Now, either with him in presence or with his memories, it will take place. Militias usually fight against the central government. However, perhaps the most effective method that General Soleimani used to gain victory was to persuade these forces to fight alongside the central government against the threat posed by the terrorists. His method transformed the Islamic Republic from a country that was engaged in defending itself against Ba'athist attacks imposed on its soil decades ago into a force which in this decade has its senior military commander driven in his vehicle nonstop all the way from Tehran to Lebanon and occupied Palestine. The value of a gift, whether small or big, will be determined in time. The Arabic scarf of General Soleimani, which is in the hands of this teenager 1 year after the commander's martyrdom, has undoubtedly turned into the flag and symbol of the town. A flag that reminds one of the martyrs. This scarf is the flag of 8 years of Iraq's history. This scarf has the scent of all the Iraqi and Iranian martyrs whose blood blended with one another. The terrorists had blocked the entrance to Amerli of food and non-food consignments by land. The rivers leading to the town had been blocked as well. That is why the women in this town, who have a custom of throwing rice on the heads of the fighters who had defended them, have nothing to throw on the heads of the victors today to celebrate the town's liberation. However, there was nothing to worry about because the days of the abundance were near. Abu Mahdi had been to Amerli before. General Soleimani had witnessed several other areas that had been under siege as well. However, when the two of them came together, it was a game changer that altered all equations. Everyone knew that this combination meant support and courage. After Amerli was turned for Tikrit and then Mosul, and later on, Aleppo and Bukema, and probably in the future, it will be the occupied lands. A winning combination must not be changed. They were together. Even at the earthquake in Saripul Zahab, they were together. Even during the floods in Khuzestan, they were together once more in January 2020. They are still together, with arms on each other's shoulders. They're watching over us to make sure we stay together. The small town of Amerli taught us amazingly big lessons.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
limelight.
Trump's nightmarish giveaway to polluters will sicken millions of most vulnerable people across the U.S., says Julia Conley, writer, in an article published under the heading, "This Must Be Undone. Trump, EPA, finalizes anti-science rule to limit use of public health research." Stay tuned for the details, please. Public health and environmental science experts on Tuesday, January 5th, said the EPA's newly finalized rule limiting the research that can be used to pass regulations must be reversed by the incoming Biden administration to end President Donald Trump's coddling of polluting industries. Basing its decision on what one former EPA scientist called a conspiracy theory about secrecy at the agency, Administrator Andrew Wheeler finalized the Strengthening Transparency in Regulatory Science rule, which will require researchers to disclose raw data, including personal medical records from their public health studies, before the agency will pass new regulations relying on the research. The rule will apply to those response studies in which scientists evaluate how much of a substance creates adverse health outcomes in people. With what the Trump administration has called the secret science rule in place, the EPA could decline to regulate dangerous emissions if it doesn't have access to raw data, including many records that are confidential. Trump's nightmarish giveaway to polluters will sicken millions of most vulnerable people across the U.S., said Family Knob, EPA policy specialist at the Center for Biological Diversity. This absurd rule forces the EPA to stick its head in the sand and pretend the most vital science about people's health doesn't exist. In an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal on Monday, January 5th, former coal lobbyist Wheeler framed the rule as one aimed at protecting Americans' personal freedom, writing, "If the American people are to be regulated by interpretation of these scientific studies, they observe to scrutinize the data as part of the scientific process and American self-government." The fact that most human health data cannot legally be given to the EPA to help it make regulatory decisions, said epidemiologist Eric Figelding, is an evil catch. The people pushing it are claiming it's in the interest of science, but the entire independent science world says it's not. Chris Zabra, a former director of the EPA Science Advisory Board, told the Washington Post, "This is a bold attempt to get science out of the way so special interests can do what they want." Now that the rule is finalized, Joe Biden and his incoming team at the EPA will likely face months of work to overturn the measure, according to the Post. Scientists called on Biden to begin working immediately on reversing the rule when he takes office on January 20th. Thankfully, this administration and its cuddling of polluting industries is finally coming to an end, said Vijay Limai, a climate and health scientist at the Natural Resources Defense Council. Unwinding this action must be at the top of the agenda for the new leadership at EPA, because it undermines everything else the agency wants and needs to do. We look forward to working with the incoming administration to get back to using sound science to guide policies that protect health and combat the climate crisis. Several members of the science community debunked the notion that disclosing raw personal data is necessary to effectively regulate pollution. There is no evidence EPA practices secret science, former head of the Office of Science Advisor Thomas Sinks told the Post. I'm unaware of an example where EPA hasn't clearly stated what science it is using in its rulemaking. Dr. Gretchen Goldman of the Union for Concerned Scientists pointed to what she called excessive requirements scientists must fulfill in order for their research to be used by the EPA. At UCS, Dr. Andrew Rosenberg noted that the EPA is weakening its own ability to regulate pollution in the midst of a pandemic and climate crisis in which poor health outcomes have been linked to heavy exposure to emissions. EPA has chosen to finalize these restrictions on science during the worst public health crisis in our lifetime, said Rosenberg in a statement. This rule would interfere with the agency's urgent, ongoing work on a range of issues, including links between environmental factors and COVID-19, the impacts of wildfire smoke on public health, and the effects of the pesticide chlorpyrifos on children, by undermining the EPA's ability to use the best available science. It's a willful decision to throw away the exact tools the agency needs now. That EPA leadership has overruled the input of the scientific community, the voices of environmental justice advocates, and simple common sense to push this rule is beyond disappointing, he added. It's a deliberate refusal to protect people's lives.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is an excerpt of the speech delivered on October 24, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the officials of the National Anti-Coronavirus Headquarters.
Of course, countries have different performances in managing coronavirus. Not all countries are the same. Some countries, such as the US, whose management is among the worst ones on this matter, have had the worst management, and some are in a better condition. We should try to exercise the best management so that we can pass through this event. This is a very important event. The thing that some people did a couple of weeks ago concerning the administration, the president, and executive officials were wrong, even though there are good brothers among those who did it. I wish to openly say that criticizing is different from insulting. Insulting officials, no matter which ones, is not permitted. Even among the masses of the people, insulting is haram and impermissible. But in the case of officials, it is even more so, particularly in the case of high-ranking officials of the country.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
Might have some legitimate and correct criticisms, and you have the right to voice them. But it is one thing to criticize, it is quite another to insult and to stain people's names. This is a very important point which everyone should pay attention to. Such actions and such insults are typical of the Americans who have scandalized themselves throughout the world. They have ruined their reputation in their debates, in their encounters, in their press, and in their media. Health officials should do something to identify and to treat the patients from the first, second day. Experts have said to me that if this is done, the number of casualties will decrease to 1/10. Well, this is very important. We should do everything we can in this regard. Unfortunately, we sometimes see on television that in certain places and discussions, there are some people and some officials who do not even wear a mask or who do not wear it correctly, who show negligence and who do not observe social distancing regulations. Officials should observe these regulations. When officials do not do so, the people feel that observing them is not really necessary.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
Bloomberg's year-end report on the wealth of the world's billionaires shows that the richest 500 people on the planet added $1.8 trillion to their combined wealth in 2020, accumulating a total net worth of $7.6 trillion. Surging billionaire wealth hits a painful nerve for the millions of people who have lost loved ones and experienced declines in their health, wealth, and livelihoods, says Julia Conley, writer, in an article published under the heading, Amid Warnings of Surging Worldwide Poverty, Planet's 500 Richest People Added $1.8 Trillion to Combined Wealth in 2020. Please stay tuned for the details of this article. Bloomberg's year-end report on the wealth of the world's billionaires shows that the richest 500 people on the planet added $1.8 trillion to their combined wealth in 2020, accumulating a total net worth of $7.6 trillion. The Bloomberg Billionaires Index recorded its largest annual gain in the list's history last year, with a 31% increase in the wealth of the richest people. The historic hoarding of wealth came as the world confronted the coronavirus pandemic and its corresponding economic crisis, while the United Nations last month warned is a tipping point set to send more than 207 million additional people into extreme poverty in the next decade, bringing the number of people living in extreme poverty to 1 billion by 2030. Even in the richest country in the world, the United States, the rapidly widening gap between the richest and poorest people grew especially stark in 2020. As Dan Price, an entrepreneur and advocate of fair wages, tweeted, the 500 richest people in the world amassed as much wealth in 2020 as the poorest 165 million Americans have earned in their entire lives. 9 of the top 10 richest people in the world live in the United States and own more than $1.5 trillion. Meanwhile, with more than half of the U.S. adults living in households that lost income due to the pandemic, nearly 26 million Americans reported having insufficient food and other groceries in November, contributing to a rise in shoplifting of essential goods, including diapers and baby formula. About 12 million renters were expected to owe nearly $6,000 in back rent after the new year. Tesla CEO Elon Musk enjoyed a historic growth in wealth last year, becoming the second richest person in the world and knocking Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates down to third place. Musk's total net worth grew by $142 billion in 2020 to $170 billion, the fastest creation of personal wealth in history, according to Bloomberg. Amazon founder Jeff Bezos is at the top of the list with a net worth of $190 billion. Bezos added more than $75 billion to his wealth in 2020 as the public grew dependent on online shopping due to COVID-19 restrictions and concern for public health. while Bezos and a select few others in the U.S. have amassed historic gains and personal wealth in the last year, the federal government has yet to extend much in the way of meaningful assistance to struggling Americans. The Republican-led Senate recently continued to stonewall a vote on legislation that would send $2,000 checks to many American households. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell denounced the proposal as socialism for rich people, even though the plan includes a phase-out structure and individuals making only up to $115,000 per year, not those in the highest tax brackets, would receive checks. Surging billionaire wealth hits a painful nerve for the millions of people who have lost loved ones and experienced declines in their health, wealth, and livelihoods. Chuck Collins, director of the Program on Inequality and the Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies, told Bloomberg recently, "Worse, it undermines any sense that Americans are in this together. The solidarity required to weather the difficult moments ahead," he said. Doc Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing those who feel the fire burning. And joining me in the studio, we have Lee Singer, who is a film journalist and video essayist, whose work has appeared in various major newspapers, magazines, and online outlets. He's also a program advisor for the BFI London Film Festival. And Nassim Ahmed, who is a political analyst and writer for Middle East Monitor. Now, Those Who Feel the Fire Burning, directed and written by Morgan Kanibe, is an unconventional, artistic, and powerful documentary about the refugee crisis. The film shows the level of poverty, humiliation, and other afflictions the refugees have to endure as they are stuck in a hopeless situation on the borders of Europe. Welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, that was a very emotional documentary. Lee, if I can start with you first. Now, there's been a wave of documentaries about the refugee crisis. What makes this documentary so unique and different?
Well, I think the first question is it even a straight documentary? I mean, definitions are very fluid, but I would term it an essay film, which is a film that kind of blurs the lines between fiction and documentary and is often operating a kind of very sort of meditative or contemplative tone with a sort of very, you know, focused first person thing. And what they do in this film with this kind of free floating, you know, disembodied point of view is
you're sort of a wandering ghost, aren't
you're
you?
You're a ghost, yeah. It's at the beginning there's a very harrowing shipwreck, and it's as if one of the people who didn't make it from that crossing is now sort of wandering as a sort of spirit around Europe and sort of encountering various,